All right, another month, another podcast with songwriters talking about the hits they've written for themselves and sometimes for others. And this month's guest has actually done a bit of both. I'm Tom Maley, and this is Write You a Song. But first, I want to thank you for taking time each month to download and listen to Write You a Song. We recently passed 14,000 downloads, and while I'm honestly not sure if that's a lot, I'm going to say it is because it sounds like it. I appreciate the interest you show in this podcast, and I hope you're able to share it with others who enjoy songwriting as well. This month, we're talking to a guy who started out as a musician and frontman for the early 90s band McBride and the Ride. They had some success, but when they broke up, Terry McBride caught a ride with Ronnie Dunn of Brooks and Dunn. McBride became kind of Ronnie Dunn's bus pal, and through several national tours, the two wrote some of Brooks and Dunn's biggest hits on the road between gigs. This guy is fun. He's amazingly talented. He even has some new music of his own coming out. Terry McBride, this month on Write You a Song. All right, so Terry McBride, welcome to Write You a Song. Thank you so much. And we were just laughing, kind of getting ready for the interview. I had a chance to just briefly, like, exchange waves with you on Ronnie Dunn's bus back in about 1996 when Brooks and Dunn were playing a fairgrounds here in Sacramento and had to go backstage and got to, you know, do a meet and greet. And Ronnie, my partner Pat, looked back and said, "Is that Terry McBride?" And you're kind of in the back of the bus. And Ronnie said, "Yeah, he's coming out with us and writing some songs together." And come to find out, that was your first run with Ronnie and kind of solidifying what became a really good working songwriting partnership.
Well, it did, Tom. That, as we were saying sort of before we got started here, I had some experience with Brooks and Dunn. We were nominated for, I think, an ACM New Group of the Year in 92. Mm-hmm. So Diamond Rio, McBride and the Ride, and Brooks and Dunn, of course. We sold about 500,000 copies that year, and Brooks and Dunn sold about 7 million. So needless to say, they took home the award that night. But but I sort of struck up a little friendship with Kix because he had written a song that went on to be a hit for me called Sacred Ground. And then ran into Ronnie at the awards. And then as my band was winding down, Brooks and Dunn recorded one of my songs, a song called I Am That Man. That was in 96. And then Ronnie invited me over to his home. We kind of hit it off, you know, like we had a lot in common personally, musically. And then he said, "Man, I'm getting off the band bus. I'm getting my own bus. And why don't you come join me? I'm heading out to California." And that was that run that you had mentioned. We started out, they did a lot of cool fairs and festivals, and the Tonight Show, worked our way up all the way up to near Seattle, and 15-day run. I think we wrote 10 songs on that trip and had a couple hits, actually, that came out of that run. And that run led to 13 years. It was 13 years later before I got off the darn bus. But
wow.
It was it was certainly a wonderful and, you know, very creative experience, to say the least. You know, we had a lot of success and a whole lot of fun while we were doing it. So it was it was great. I look back on it now, and it was just a wonderful period and time in my life.
What do you think? What was it that clicked between the two of you?
Well, it was a combination of things, Tom. Vocally, we're both sort of those, you know, hillbilly tenors, and we like that sort of rangy kind of melodies. So that played into my favor as far as me just throwing an idea melodically out to Ronnie. He could sing it, whatever I could sing. Of course, he could sing, and he's a fantastic vocalist. And so that was a big plus right off the bat. Then our family, our upbringing, our musical taste were very similar. I mean, we had so much in common. We were really surprised as we slowly got to know each other on that 15-day run. You really get to know a guy well on a 45-foot bus.
Yeah.
Nowhere I could go to my bunk, maybe, but that's about it. So we spent a lot of time, especially as the years went by. And then we did a lot of stuff outside of just touring. We went on some great hunting trips. A lot of, at that particular time, they were involved in NASCAR, Dale Earnhardt, and things like that. So we did a lot of good, you know, buddy, friend, pal stuff. You know, it was just a lot of fun. But we had so much in common, and it was just a natural. Ronnie is very sort of a introverted type of person. He's not that outgoing. Mm-hmm. He is a star, you know, but he's not that comfortable in that spotlight setting. Now, singing, he completely can own it, you know, but so he doesn't, he was a little apprehensive about even inviting me to come out because he just didn't have any real close person like that, and he hadn't been inviting anybody out. So we didn't know how it was going to go, but fortunately for me, it went really well and continued to go well up until when they finally called it quits, you know, back in 2010 or whatever that was.
I was going through some of the over 20 songs that you wrote for and with Ronnie. And did you write with Kix at all?
We did. Yeah, okay. We had a couple of songs in there. And actually, when Brooks and Dunn took their break and Kix came out, I had Kix's single called New to This Town. Mm-hmm. Wish I was new to this town, just pulling in and checking it out for the first time. Wish I could go anywhere and not be afraid of finding you there. Yeah, girl, when I see you around, I wish I was new to this town. I wrote that with Marv Green, and I had a couple songs on with Brooks and Dunn. I had a couple cuts that Kix wrote. You know, after the show at night and everybody's going from bus to bus, Kix would come over and visit. Mainly, I rode down the highway with Ronnie, but yeah, Kix would come over and have a cocktail or a beer or whatever, and we'd start talking, and it could sometimes lead to a songwriting session. And Kix is just a wonderful, he's been so good to me as a friend over the years, very supportive, very, you know, he's one of those guys, he has all the same friends from high school and college. He's just grounded, down-to-earth individual. And once he met me, he just kind of treated me the same way. He just included me in all kinds of great things. And so we just had a hoot, you know, out there on the road. It was so much fun.
And if I remember right, New to This Town had Joe Walsh on it too, right?
That's right. He got Joe Walsh to play some really cool slide guitar. Was a really good song. It actually took off. We thought we were going to have a hit, and it ended up getting, you know, it was a little hit. It just wasn't the big song that we had all hoped for, but that was a really good song. I thought Kix really did a great job on that tune, and it was fun. It was just cool that he would wanted me to come be part of that process of him putting together a solo record.
Yeah. And both Ronnie and Kix accomplished writers themselves. Did they approach songwriting differently? What did you have to like adapt to each one, or were there similar? What was it like?
No, not at all. You know, personally, they are different people, very different in mm-hmm. some ways. But when it came down to business, and I'm talking like merchandise to whatever, they kind of saw eye to eye on who they were, their brand, their music, and their direction. Now, when I came along, they were going through some changes. They were changing producers. Ronnie was sort of, you know, isolating himself a little bit because he got this bus. You know, they were all on the same bus with the band for the very first few years of the success they were having. Then they became so big that they wanted to start bringing family and friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, but Ronnie had family, but he had no friends. So I came along and became his only friend really at the time. And and before that, he was just like hanging out on his bus by himself. So they weren't writing as much during that period. So I kind of came in and filled that void. And I didn't know the dynamics of what was happening on the road, but they would always sit down and they knew what they wanted to get, how they wanted their look and everything to come across together. They would work on that, and they were very smart about that. And Kix is a very diligent writer. He would bring his friends, Bob DePiro, who I know you've interviewed and talked with, and that's one of Kix's big buddies. And I love Bob. They're just he's a great hang and a wonderful songwriter. So they both kind of had their own thing going, but occasionally, like you said when we were discussing earlier, we would get together and write something. And it was just fun. You know, after they come off the stage, they've got all that energy. And that's where I found if I had a good idea, I could capture that moment of, you know, Ronnie, he's kind of high from the performance, 15,000 people, you know, screaming and yelling for you. And then you get on the bus. What do you do with that? So we kind of channeled that into a lot of songwriting as we were going down the road. Probably wrote 90% of every cut I had with them was probably written on the bus.
That is a fascinating angle and one I haven't heard yet. You talk to a lot of songwriters and they have their, you know, songwriting sessions or, you know, they keep their notes all over the place. But I haven't heard that approach before. Ronnie would come off of the stage and he'd just be fired up. And
oh, yeah.
Is it like you just you've got the adrenaline going, the creative juices are flowing, and you recognize that as a co-writer, and you would try to just kind of ride the lightning, so to speak.
You're exactly right, Tom. When we were winding down that very first run of 15 days, we had written some good stuff. I knew we had a couple really good things, but I was thinking, man, if I could just come up with one more thing. And I was on the bus while the show was going on. I could hear Ronnie singing, you know, and I had this little idea. I had a little bit of a chorus, and it would turn into be a song called He's Got You. And a rangy kind of tune there again, something that Ronnie could really have a powerful vocal. And when he literally went off the stage onto the bus, I went, hey, man, I think I got an idea. He's like, well, play it for me. We sat down. By the time they loaded up and we had kind of a quick leave that night, they had the crowd all where we could get out with the buses. By the time we left, we got to the hotel. We had the song written that night, probably a little less than an hour on that song in particular.
I thought we would always be together. The love we shared was gonna last forever. Once I was your one and only. Now here I sit, Mr. Lonely.
Yeah, it didn't always happen like that. I wish it could, but it doesn't. And then one night in particular, Ronnie came off stage, and he was excited. Hot chick down front was yelling at him to play something country, she was saying. And so he bounced up on the bus. He goes, man, this hot chick's down there yelling to play something country. He goes, you know, that could be a song. And I went, man, it could. So we started playing, and then he started singing in his head. He had this guitar lick that neither one of us could play, but he could hum it, you know, and sing it. So when it came time to record that song, we both sang that lick into the guitar player's ear on each side. And he said, I talked to him later, JT Cornfloss, an amazing, amazing guitar player. He said, man, when you guys sat me down and sang that lick, he goes, I had no trouble playing it. You knew it so well. You know?
She blew through the door like TNT. Put her hand on her hip, pointed her finger at me. Said, I'm a whiskey drinking cowboy chasing hell of a time. I like Kenny, Keith, Allen, and Patsy Cline. I'm a full grown queen bee looking for honey. Hi-hoo-hoo, I'll play something country.
That was an instance in one of those moments where that energy from the stage just poured into a song, and it came from really that place. Then we're rolling down the road. Then you get a little bit of the verse. You get a little bit of the chorus. Now you're really excited, you know. And that led to many a 4 a.m. writing session, you know, or the sun coming up, really. a lot of days like that.
Well, and that leads to I've got like 9 questions bottled up right now. But when you hit the ground running like that with a Play Somethin' Country, which I think was their fastest rising number one that they ever had out of all of their hits, which is remarkable.
Wow.
Is there a momentum that you can, and you kind of just answered that question, but is there a real genuine momentum that you can ride and get more songs out of it?
Oh, absolutely. Once you sort of, strike gold with a song like that, and you look back at, how much fun you had and how good it was, I found something interesting recently, Tom. I just finished a new album, and we have a couple of singles that have come from it. The album's coming in October, but Luke Laird produced the album for me. And when I met Luke, he was on the road with Brooks and Dunn. He was selling merchandise. He was setting up meet and greets. He was doing whatever they needed him. I knew him as just a great guy and had no idea he had any dreams of being a songwriter. And then he told me, we let him ride the bus with us once from Nashville to Canada. And Ronnie and I wrote a song called That's What She Gets for Loving Me. Mm-hmm. And he sat there quietly and just watched us write that song. And he told me recently we were doing some interviews together to do a little PR for this album. And, of course, now Luke just celebrated his, 24th number one song.
Yep.
He's had a phenomenal career. But his take from it back then was like, man, I was just amazed at how well you guys worked together and how quickly you could come up with lines and how quickly you wrote that song, And I said, wow, that's crazy, because I barely even remembered it was that trip, until he reminded me. But
at times I lay awake at night, stare at her laying by my side, knowing there in her heart as she sleeps, she can forever count on me. Well, that's what she gets. Yeah, that's what she gets. That's what she gets for loving me.
When you've got a connection like that and you feel comfortable and you can openly express yourself, then good things can sometimes come from that, instead of being a little apprehensive or a little embarrassed about the goofy idea or line you might spit out, with Ronnie, I felt very comfortable critiquing him even, nobody did that to Ronnie, and I do it all the time. I critique him and beat him up over lines and tell him his ideas were horrible, whatever, just to mess with him, because nobody else ever did that to him. And he loved that about me. Even when he was singing live and saying stuff, I was like, man, you're talking, nobody can understand a word you're saying. It's like, you're killing the audience. He's like, man, nobody tells me that kind of stuff. But he loved it that I would be honest with him. And I use that same approach with songwriting, just was honest and open. And like I said, sometimes good things can come from that.
Well, how important is it during a collaboration to as Rodney Clausen, one of the other songwriters I've talked to, put it, to dare to suck? To not be afraid to throw.
That's
vital
way to put it.
Yeah, you can't just hold back and only throw out your good ideas. You've got to kind of just throw everything against the wall, but you've got to be in a comfortable enough situation where if you do throw out a clunker of an idea, you're not going to get eye rolls or laughed out of the room.
Well, that comes with experience. In the beginning, I was so intimidated because, Tom, I hit the ground running here in Nashville. I was fortunate. I met a couple good songwriters in Texas, a husband and wife team, Bill Carter and Ruth Ellsworth, sort of took me in through some little demos of mine they had heard and some very average songs with a decent vocal kind of thing, but they saw something in me, took me in. And then we went out on the road. I played in Bill's band, and we opened for Stevie Ray Vaughan all the way from Austin, Texas to New York City and back. It was just phenomenal. About 1987. And then we struck up a friendship. We started writing, and they just elevated my songwriting immediately, because all of a sudden I went from writing alone to writing with people who had written songs for Stevie Ray Vaughan, Fabulous Thunderbirds, and things like that. It was, I was fortunate to have that experience, but I was intimidated. Then when I got my record deal, I came to Nashville, my label, MCA, they took it upon themselves to start setting me up. My first co-write in Nashville and growing up in Texas was with Guy Clark.
Wow.
So, oh my gosh, Tom, I was just, I grew up in the 70s when the Texas music progressive country scene was exploding, and Jerry Jeff Walker was a huge part of that. Willie Nelson, who I idolized, was my hero. But I kept seeing these songs, I kept finding these songs that I loved, you know, Desperado's Waiting for a Train, L.A. Freeway, Rita Blue, and this guy named Guy Clark, his name was on it. You know, I didn't know who he was, but he was writing some of my favorite songs. So then fast forward to 1990, and my first co-write in Nashville is with Guy, and oh my gosh, I couldn't sleep. I tried to have a few good ideas, a few bad ideas, you know, and just meeting my hero. I met him. He's kind of a hulk of a guy, you know. And then I tried to germ him a bit and tell him how wonderful he was and what he meant to me. He's like, oh, the hell with that. You know, he was like, and I went, oh, no, now I'm pissed off Guy Clark. You know, I was all over the place going, oh, no, I just want him to love me and take me in. And you know, in a roundabout way, he did. I shared an idea that he liked. And then we worked on it. We kind of hit it off. He just kind of made me feel you know, he just welcomed in some sort of way, and I was just kind of getting started, just finding my way. But through that song, then later he invited me over to his place, and we kind of continued to write off and on. I never wrote any one masterpiece with him. I think I was just too much in awe of him, you know. Just I had him up on a level where I just couldn't be myself. I couldn't openly express myself like we're talking about, Tom, circling my way back to what you had mentioned. But when you are able to do that, yes, it works great. And I've had many a co-writer and friend that'll go, listen, this may sound stupid, but I want to get it out there, you know. And a lot of times, as awkward, as strange or as out of the box as it may, the line or the idea might be, it's sometimes the cool line that gets you to the next line.
What was the song you wrote with him? Was it recorded?
No, you know, actually, we did go back years later. He contacted me, and I think I was riding with him, and he was getting ready to go back in and do like a little demo vault, songs from the vault kind of project. Mm-hmm. Rodney Crowell was there that day. I don't remember the title of that song. Gosh, it's 1990. I have it in my file of songs, but and we did work on that song, and I think that might have turned into a little project for Guy at that time, but my whole thing with him was just, gosh, getting to be around him. And he had this wonderful little wood shop working area in his house where he was making these hand-built, wonderful classical sort of guitars that he was working on. And, you know, he was a craftsman in many ways, you know, songwriting and woodworking. And he was just an interesting Renaissance man. You know, it was just thrilling to kind of be able to hang with sort of a hero of that magnitude. And of course, he's the kind of guy, when I told him, you know, what a big influence, he didn't care about that kind of stuff at all. He just wasn't that kind of guy at all, but certainly a gifted person. I got to be part of a tribute to him in Austin, and it was just thrilling. And a lot of artists that I respect and look up to, a lot of Texas guys were part of that. And I just was thinking, man, this is like, some kind of dream come true, just to be in the same circle of some sorts, you know, of these type of people, rub elbows with them. And I just, that's the great thing about this business. I started out as a fan and loved music, loved songwriters, and I could find their names. My dad had Billboard magazine because my dad was an entertainer, singer, mm-hmm. songwriter. And I'd start to see these names pop up, whether it was Harlan Howard or, you know, whoever from the day in the 70s. And then I start to see Dean Dillon and just people that I like, and I start to see their names popping up a lot. You know, I just, but they seemed bigger than life to me, you know, and then later getting to meet them, it was just such a thrill.
Well, to a lot of young songwriters, you're bigger than life. You've got such a storied career. When you do co-writes with young songwriters, do you find yourself kind of empathizing with them? Because I'm sure they come into the room and they're in awe of you.
Well, that's kind of you to say, Tom, but I have struck up a lot of friendships with these younger artists. It's kind of part of my career now. I guess I'm in my mentoring phase of my career. When I find somebody like that, it's a great feeling because And I'm finding that with a lot of these younger Texas artists, they really look up to what I've done. And that's just the highest compliment, you know, to get that sort of respect from people who are wanting to do what I've done. And but it's a real genuine feeling, and they let you know that how much they appreciate your time and your craft of trying to put these songs together. But yeah, it is interesting. It's so funny because I was always the youngest guy, no matter what band I was in. And now I'm 62 this year, so it's quite shocking. But
I relate to that so much. Forever in radio, I was the youngest guy at the stations that I was working at, and now all of a sudden I'm like you. Yeah. When did that happen? I don't even remember when that. You know, like I swung past the balance point. You know, it's just like
I don't either, Tom. I'm in that same place. I mean, I still feel good. I can still sing. I went out last year and did played about 45 shows. Acoustic solo songwriter dates. Some of them were just fantastic and wonderful, and some were small and challenging, but overall it was a great experience. But I look up and it's like, gosh, who is this guy? And where I recently have been doing, I took a 20-year break from performing. So when I came back, everything, a lot of things had changed. One, me, you know, the way I look. And
right.
Started taking these photo sessions, and then I'm going like, what, where is that wrinkle and where did that come from? And I was recently with a whole lot of young people and several young girls that helped me and work with me, my project manager and my social media girls, all these people, they're just talented and brilliant. But I took them all to lunch one day and I said, you're looking at the photo shoot, they're like, man, you look good. I said, listen, my neck, I don't know when that happened, you know, but I've got these wrinkles and things. So I told them, listen, don't get attached to your neck, whatever you do, because it's the first to go.
If you're lucky, a pandemic will hit and you have to wear a mask all the time and people don't notice.
No kidding. That's not been that bad for me, honestly. I don't mind suiting up and masking up and hiding out. I wore sunglasses my entire professional career because of that. I could just kind of hide behind them, I felt, you know. But, yeah, I'm not opposed to that one bit.
What, talk just a little bit more about writing with younger people, and do you learn from them?
Oh, man, absolutely, because that where they're coming from musically is so different. Yesterday I wrote with a 21-year-old kid from Texas, just a great kid, Tristan Mars. Is his name. He's really kind of making a little bit of a name for himself down there. You know, lots of streaming and he's not doing a lot of concerts right now, but he's one of those up and coming kind of kids. And just to hear how he got into music, how they learned about it, and what he did, concerts when he was in high school was a safe place to go and drink, which I thought was interesting, you know, because when he would go see Cody Johnson, which his group of kids, when they were growing up in Texas, they loved Cody, and they didn't listen to as much radio, that little generation, because, you know, they were having everything was on a phone or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So they would start to share stuff, but of course then Cody's on the radio now, so of course that's all changed for them. But it was a safe place where he and his friends could get together and they could just kind of, you know, have beers or whatever, and then they would, you know, they'd have someone get him home or whatever. He wasn't reckless and just careless completely. But it's funny how they found music and how they shared it and how they get to know it. And that's from a young, young kid, you know. So that, and then there are tons of these young guys that are programmers, and it's all over the map, really, with music these days. But you're right. It doesn't if you're really wise as you're getting older, you realize you still can learn something from this younger generation, no doubt about it.
I'd say getting ready for this interview, you know, I went back and watched some old McBride and the Ride videos, which took me back. God, how much did you guys spend on hairspray?
But it's embarrassing. I hate to even tell you, Tom. I hate to even admit the amount of hairspray. But, you know, we were a country hair band. What can I say? The mullet was on fire, so we embraced it with everything we had.
I mean, that was the thing. But the deeper thing is listening to those songs. God, that was like seriously good country. You can count on me. I'll be true. Do you feel the same?
My songs were so simple. They came from a real simple place of, you know, loving those songs growing up, whether it was, you know, George Jones or Merle Haggard or Gary Stewart or whatever. I was influenced by tons of stuff when I was young. But very simple with, hopefully a good melody and a good, lyric that had a little bit of meat on it and something that could connect. You know, I knew what it took. And then eventually we ended up having a few of those songs that just really connected with that audience. And, of course, our harmony thing was a big part of what we were doing back then. But we were such a good band. I recently found last week, Tom, cassettes from board tapes from 1992. One of them was Red Rocks outside of Denver. And it was opening for Wynonna on her solo tour, Us, Hal Ketchum, and Wynonna. But the crowd is amazing. The band is so good. We were doing about 200 dates a year. And now all these years later, I will play those songs acoustically, and they still connect. They still hold up. And I have the original fans, and now I have their children of the original fans. And they are every bit as passionate as the moms and dads were from back in the 90s. It means so much to these kids. And I'm talking 20s, 30-year-old kids, you know, as far as, you know, I'm calling them kids, but they're adults, but that's how they learned the music, and then it means so much to them. I hear from them, people like that all the time, and now by continuing to release new music and continuing to keep moving forward, I'm still building a little audience, and it's been interesting and exciting for me at the same time, just to kind of still be in this after all these years where a lot of people just are not. It just, music has such a way of weeding out those that just aren't completely committed and all in. It just can be brutal in the beginning, and there's just no glory, there's no money, and I've talked about that with a lot of people, you know, and a lot of people just can't take it and don't want to, and they go on and have careers and do other things and are even talented people. I have a lot of friends like that that are weekend warriors or whatever now, but it's an interesting business, and I still find it interesting. I guess that's why I'm still able to continue to do a few things, even like this today, you and I talking about this stuff. It's like, it's great. You continue to find a way to stay in the business, and now you have this podcast that's really interesting, which I enjoyed a few of your episodes already. And if you don't do that, then you just quickly get left behind. You have to keep moving.
Well, I love just hearing the excitement, enthusiasm, and enthusiasm in your voice, you know, after all this time. You're still as stoked about it. And I still feel the same way about radio. I still love what we do. But the reason I brought up, you know, your early stuff is that your latest stuff, the album, by the way, this is dropping in November. So the album, which is Rebels and Angels, is out now by Terry McBride. The two songs that I was able to listen to, Calling All Hearts and Rebels and Angels, the title track, which we'll get into a little more detail in a minute. You have same rootsy country sound there for people who are nostalgic, sort of. I don't even know if it's nostalgic. It's like the baseline country sound, and that's BASE line country sound. You know what I mean? It's pure and it's real and it's as country as it gets, if that makes sense.
Wow. Well, that's good to hear, Tom. And yes, I completely understand what you're saying. And it's become very evident to me recently, you know, I'm from Texas and a big part of my audience is there. California was a huge market for us back in the day. We did a lot of touring out there. So I've released a little single. This Texas music scene is so popular.
And the single,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, the single is called Calling All Hearts.
That's it. That's the single. And their feedback to me is, wow, it sort of has a little bit of that 90s vibe. We can recognize your voice from that era, but it still feels like it fits on the radio. And that's just the best. Yeah. I mean, to hear something like that, for a guy like me, that's just the best, great feedback.
It started out harmless and innocent. just like it does every time. She said I was the one, so I went with it. Oh, and I lost more than my mind. And she walked out for no reason. She left me lonely.
Is one that you actually wrote with Chris Stapleton. And so you co-wrote with him, and then you've got one of the most phenomenal female voices of all time singing back up on it, Patti Loveless. Just talk a little bit about Rebels and Angels, the title track.
You bet. I mean, Tom, that was like I was on a period where I was writing a lot of Chris Stapleton, and we were fortunate. We had some really cool cuts, you know, from Alan Jackson to whoever during the period of whatever time we were writing. Heck, you know, Chris could get a song cut on just a work tape. His vocals are so fantastic. But that particular song, Rebels and Angels, as I was trying to think about putting an album together, I love that song. And I knew in my heart it will never be recorded. One, it's just so country. And two, it's a waltz. I mean, it had everything going against it, you know. And but I love the song. And then one day when I was listening down to it, it just like a light bulb went off. It's as if I'd heard it for the first time. And the lyrics, lyrically in that song, it just lent itself well to a duet. I mean, it's Rebels and Angels. It's this rebel and it's this angel. And when I started thinking about an angel, Patti Loveless just came to my mind because I'm such a fan of her. She's one of my favorite singers of all time. And so it was a ballsy thing on my part to do. I hadn't talked to Patti in a long time. She hit me right back and said, Terry, I love this song. And she made this song so special, and it became sort of the centerpiece of this new album just because I had her on there. And I just love how country it is. My favorite part, Tom, of that song is so country, fiddle and steel right off the bat. But then when it modulates and we go into the second verse for Patti, that fiddle and steel on that turn, it just kills me. It's like something you don't ever even hear anymore, but that's why I love it.
These songs they're so different and you kind of downplay it, and, you know, wouldn't get airplay today. But then in the next breath, you're saying people are interested in it. And I think people are interested in that stuff because it is different, because it is, it reminds you, it's very reflective of something that we're familiar with, but at the same time, it's something completely new.
Well, you're exactly right. And it's songs like that, Tom, and it's artists that sort of take a chance every now and then. I don't know what I have in store for me in the future. And I really didn't have any master plan going into it. I just knew I'm at a place where I could record a song like that. I don't have anyone telling me what I can or can't do. So I'm just kind of going with my gut and my taste and what I want. And that song just called to me. And because of that, like you said, it's either reminiscent or it has the qualities of something that's either missing or it reminds people of whatever. But the response to it has just been so wonderful that I really can't wait to see what happens next.
One of the things that I found about a lot of the songwriters that I've talked with is versatility, even if it's accidental. And in your case, a song, I think you wrote it for Easton Corbin, Are You With Me, became an EDM hit.
Yes. The biggest song I've written to date, Tom, is an EDM hit. I'm a country singer. I'm a country songwriter. And the biggest song I've had is that European smash. It was just this kid from Belgium heard a sort of an unplugged, stripped down version of Easton Corbin doing it on YouTube. He was just surfing the internet, whatever. And he loved this little octave, which Easton's version is very slow ballad. Wrote that with Tommy Lee James and Shane McAnally. And it's da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da. Very slow.
I want to dance by the water neath the Mexican sky. Drink some margaritas by a string of blue lights. Listen to the mariachi play at midnight. Are you with me? Are you with me?
He loved that. That's what he loved the most. So being an EDM guy, he took it and sped it up.
I want to dance by water beneath the Mexican sky. Drink some margaritas by a string of blue lights. Listen to the mariachi play at midnight. Are you with me? Are you with me?
And even though the song had three verses and a chorus, he only used the first verse over and over and over. And the kid, his name was Lost Frequencies, but he was sort of an unknown at the time. He had had a couple covers. He licensed this song as a cover, so we kept 100% of the song, the copyright, and he didn't even ask for anything, which isn't usually the case with an artist in Europe. But and then he released it, and it just took off, and there was no stopping it. For the summer of, I think, 2015, it was the one of the biggest songs in Europe and the UK, Australia. Ended up being number one in 18 countries and top 10 in 30, and phenomenal. I looked the other day, the video has 320 million views on YouTube.
Listen to the mariachi play at midnight. Are you with me? Are you with me? We can chase the wild.
Just to kind of wrap this up, just to send it on out, I did want to ask you, out of all of the songs you've written, what would you put in your top two or three? And they don't even necessarily have to be hits, but what is a song or two where you point to and go, man, I absolutely hit that one out of the park?
Well, I think, just looking back on my career, those first couple cuts are just unbelievable when you get someone. My second cut was George Strait, and it was, I came to town thinking I was going to get a George Strait cut because I didn't know you couldn't, But and I wrote that with Jim Lauderdale, who I dearly love. And that was a wonderful moment. It's a song called Nobody Has to Get Hurt.
We can do this thing right, fix what went wrong, really make this work. Turn around real slow, walk straight back to me. Nobody has to get hurt. We can do this thing right, fix what.
And then later went on to get a song with Marv Green called Always Never the Same. That was the title of George's album.
I know why I'm intrigued. You keep surprising me. Somewhere between the lines, there's no way to define every move you make. Always never the same.
Those songs are so special because I just put George Strait up there in that category. It's just almost untouchable. I can't even imagine that he's, I know him or have had songs recorded by him. And then I think Cowgirls Don't Cry is a special song to me just because how it kind of finally came together. We really used Reba as the inspiration for that song. And then we sent it to her like 4 a.m, the work tape and the lyric. But Ronnie and Kix cut it, even though she wanted to. And then she demanded she be on it. And that's how she ended up getting on it. They had already cut it without her. And then we went in and recut it quickly. It was crazy.
Her daddy gave her her first pony, then taught her to ride. She climbed high in that saddle. Well, I don't know how many times he taught her a lesson that she learned. Maybe a little too well. Cowgirls don't cry. Ride, baby, ride. Lessons of life are gonna show you in time. Soon enough, you're gonna know why. It's gonna hurt every now and then. If you fall, get back on again. Cowgirls don't cry.
It's just one of those songs where a lot of stuff came together, and it was just all wonderful when it did, you know?
Hey, do you golf?
I haven't much. I used to be a golfer. It's so sad, Tom. I was a golfer when I was young. Then I got away from it, and then trying to get back to it has been, oh, my God. I'm like Vince Gill. I'm throwing clubs. It's like, what the hell?
I remember
it's
asking.
So frustrating.
I asked
it's
Vince
so
Gill one time. We were at the CMAs or something, and Vince, he was going doing the radio station thing, and he sat down, and we had talked to somebody who'd golfed with him, and they told us that he was a club thrower. And, and so that was like my lead question. I go, so Vince, we hear you're a club thrower. And he just gives me this cold stare and he goes, I'll throw you. Well, the reason I ask is that if everything goes well and we're able to do events next year, there is an event here that we do in conjunction with the oldest golf course in Sacramento, and it's called Golf and Guitars. And there's actually it's a song. They do a songwriter night on the first day. You'd be perfect for this event.
Keep me in mind. I'll fake my way through the golfing, or I'll just visit with people during the day or whatever.
And the thing is, you don't have to golf. You can hang out.
Yeah, that'd be great. Here's how bad a golfer I am, Thomas. Years ago, McBride and the Right had. We came out with Amarillo Sky before Jason Aldean, 3 years before he had it. We really liked that record. So Kason asked us to come out and do a celebrity golf thing, you know. So I tried to polish up, tried to get my off the tee box. I wanted to at least be able to drive, you know. And then they had a rule where if you didn't drive past the women's tee, you had to drop your pants, you know. So by the end of the tournament, I had no pants or shirt on. That's where I was. It was not good, but I'll be damned if I still didn't have a good time. You know?
Man, you are amazing. Thank you again.
Oh, Tom, likewise, man. I really enjoyed that. I look forward to catching the podcast and see how. Good luck on the editing on that, but I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Hey, thank you. Sure. Have a great day.
Oh, you bet, Tom. Hey, take care out there, man.
Okay, will do. You too. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Phone rang early one morning. Her mama's voice, she'd been crying. Said, it's your daddy. You need to come home. This is it. I think he's dying. She laid the phone down by his head. The last words that he said. Cowgirl, don't cry. Cry, baby, ride. Lessons of life show us all the time.
And that's a wrap for this month's edition of Write You a Song. Thank you again to Terry McBride. Thank you for listening, for downloading over 14,000 times since we started this thing about a year and a half ago. If you ever want to reach out and find out anything about a past episode of Write You a Song or one of the songwriters, feel free to get a hold of me at tmailey, M-A-I-L-E-Y, at Bonneville.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. It's just at KNCI Tom. And next month, we're going to be talking to another red-hot, up-and-coming songwriter.
Well, I don't know how not to think about you. Just rocking all night long. Somebody else will find on. Walk up and ask your name right
now. Adam Hambrick, next time on Write You a Song. On the table.